The WLEW News and Public Affairs Department now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. Our guest today in the studio is Janice Stein. She is an author, and she has book number 2 coming out about one-room schoolhouses. She did one for a couple of the townships in Huron County to begin with, and those were, Sand Beach and Sherman townships. Now volume 2, a little more in-depth for Bingham, Paris, and Sheridan townships. A lot of one-room schoolhouses were out there years ago. Everybody's consolidating. We even have talk today with Port Hope becoming part of North Huron because student numbers are dropping and other factors. So it isn't something that ended. It's a work in progress, and a lot of history out there, and a lot of it could be lost without people like you trying to dig it up and preserve it. So thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. And I started researching one-room schoolhouses back in 2002 in a column for the Lakeshore Guardian called Schools of Yesteryear, and that really is what launched my interest in schoolhouses. And when we think about the education system in America, we want to go all the way back to the early days, from the colonial days through the American Revolution. All schools were privatized, and parents were solely responsible for and had complete control over their children's education. But as the nation grew, so too did our government. And soon we got the influence of government-induced objectives for education. And that necessarily wasn't a bad thing.
It standardized things. It made sure that a group of immigrants from here weren't just teaching them about the old country. They were learning about the whole world. These types of things that, they taught them what they knew and what their parents had taught them. And it broadened the horizons.
And when you look at the actual structure of it, it was really quite organized. The Northwest Ordinance of 1787 had already established guidelines that encouraged education, so that when Michigan became a territory in 1805, the land was divided into townships of 6 square miles, and those townships were subdivided into 36 sections with a minimum of 640 acres. Now, to entice people to settle here, each section was sold at public auction with a starting bid of $1. And the funds raised by the sale of Section 16 in each township were set aside to fund schools.
So they had a formula. They had a plan.
They had a plan. And so when Michigan gained its statehood in 1837, there were already things in place to help facilitate education. But by the 1850s, a massive reform beginning in the eastern seaboard states swept across the nation. And as I mentioned, states began to push for government-operated schools. But for many settlers, this flew in the face of what their founding fathers had fought for, and that was their freedom from government. Other states had already established state boards of education, and Michigan soon followed suit. And so those objectives for the Michigan State Board of Education were the state collection of education data, state adoption of textbooks through establishment of state-approved libraries in each district, so we didn't have some German families wanting to learn German and Polish families in Perrysville wanting to learn Polish. Everything was in English, and it had to be approved by the state. And another important objective was the state control of teacher preparation through the establishment of what was called normal schools or teacher colleges. So neighbor Bob down the road couldn't say he was going to be a teacher just because he felt like it. He had to get a certificate that stated he was accredited to be a teacher, and there was a fair amount of continuing education that these one-room school teachers had to meet in order to maintain their criteria.
And it also allowed the diploma they got at the end to kind of be a standardized thing that they know the basics.
Yes.
I mean, what you had in Alpena County and what you had in Emmett County and what you had in Huron County could have been totally different things. And this kind of standardized it, so when you had a high school diploma, it kind of showed you were at least meeting some common standards.
Correct. And when we think of government involvement, a lot of people immediately cringe because you think of big government involvement. But it did really facilitate standards so that all of the children were basically getting the same type of education all throughout the counties and townships through Michigan.
And richer areas weren't, getting extravagance than the poorer areas that couldn't afford to do anything. They had standards to meet as well. So it made it a little more uniform in that regard, too.
Yes. And Huron County organized in 1859, and the land here formerly belonged to Sanilac and Tuscola counties. So in my research, the first records at the state level, at the Michigan Archives in Lansing, document education in Huron County dating back to 1859. And certainly there may have been schools in this region before 1859, and there is some local evidence that suggests the same. But in the spirit of factual research, 1859 became that year for me to start with my research. And so
that's when the state had records being kept, pretty much. And there's a base.
Yes.
Because you whatever they had before could be lost in a fire, could be lost due to negligence, or we don't have enough firewood for this month to keep the schoolhouse warm. Just use those.
And that goes back to one of the objectives of the State Board of Education was that state collection of data. Every year, the school board director in each school district, in each township, had to file a report with the State Board of Education. And it was a standard report. It let everybody know the number of students that were attending that particular school. It let you know how many months of school were in attendance. In the early days, they attended 3 months in the winter. Eventually, laws came into play that said students between the ages of 18 and 14 had to attend a mandatory minimum amount of months because truancy was a big problem.
Well, and it was truancy brought on about by the fact that it's planting time and such that, you know, you're needed.
And they tried to accommodate the farmers. We are in Michigan itself as a largely agricultural area and more so in Huron County. And so in those early days, school was held in the wintertime for 3 months. And then when there was a push for additional months of education, a summer session was also held for 3 months so that students could be at home in the spring and in the fall helping their parents on the farm. And back to that 1859 date, when Huron County organized, the state records show that there were three townships along the Lake Huron shoreline that had its first schools, and that only makes sense because the schools along the shoreline had access to the lake transportation, so those townships were the first to build schools. The area was heavily wooded, and it took a while for settlers to penetrate the forest and make settlements further inland.
Did the state require kids to go to school? I mean, they could tell you that, if you know what I mean, we have, you know, today you have to, you can't quit until you're a certain age, and they want you to go even further. Were there minimum requirements, or was that one of the big things, too? You're not going to tell me my kid has to go to school.
There were requirements month-wise. Children, like I said, between 8 and 14 had to attend a minimum of 3 months of school back in the 1870s.
Did it include homeschooling if they wanted? I mean, today we have people doing that.
I'm not sure if the state had authorization at that point in time of homeschooling, because the homeschools now have certain criteria that they have to meet as well. But at its peak, Michigan had over 7,000 one-room schools. And if you think, that's a huge number.
I don't think you could go anywhere without hearing a school bell ringing during the course of a school day.
A law was passed that stated that no child could walk more than 3 miles to school. And so if you take a tour through Huron County, you can still see those structures evident. Sometimes they've been converted into storage facilities for farms. Sometimes, in the case of the Ruth Public School, which is about a little bit south of Ruth, that is now the Parisville VFW post. And so these buildings went on to serve other functions even well after they closed, but if you take a look, a lot of them have the same structure because there were guidelines for building schools as well.
That's why you can see a one-room schoolhouse and kind of recognize it, because it had to meet certain requirements that become familiar.
And one of those requirements was that the school had adequate lighting. And so if the buildings still exist, you can see they may be boarded over now, but you can see they had four or five windows on either side of the schoolhouse to let adequate light in. It was a rare event, but possibly during the winter when the kerosene lamps were lit, if there was not adequate light brought in by the windows.
Did they try to situate them on the property to take advantage of that? Because then you'd have to pay for kerosene for lamps and stuff. It seems like they were smart back then. They knew, you know, how to use the resources they had. Were they often set in a way that they'd be facing north-south, so you got the east and the west sun, so all day long there was some window that had light coming in?
I've never actually researched that, and I think schoolhouses sat in all directions, so I'm not really sure if there's any validity to that or not, but certainly in the school district, in a particular school district, if the founding members of that district or the board, the school board, which was a three-member team, if they had the foresight to think about that, certainly they likely would have taken advantage of it. As I mentioned, Michigan having over 7,000 one-room schools, in Huron County in the 1930s, we had about 130 schools. And so my first book, Schools of Yesteryear, Volume 1, that has the 15 schools that were in Sand Beach and Sherman Township, and then Volume 2, which has the 14 schools that were in Bingham, Paris, and Sheridan Township, I have a little job security when I continue on with this mission to one by one try to document the history of all these schools in Huron County. And what is really interesting is, to date, Michigan still is known for their one-room schools. Michigan now has about 18 one-room schools, and while Huron County has made some good history dating back to 1859, we continue to make history because we are still home of those 18 one-room schools in Michigan. Huron County is home to six of them.
And hopefully we can preserve a few of them and keep them going. And it gets a little harder all the time, but I know the ISD is running them, and I know we get the delays and the closings and stuff, so they're out there, and they're just families in the area utilizing a one-room school. They normally, though, now are only to a certain age, and then they go to the high school, isn't it, at this point?
K through 8.
K through 8.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get to a certain point, I think they want what they've learned with the bigger schools is the interaction, socialization with your same age group. In a one-room schoolhouse, you could have kids of all ages. I mean, you could have 8 kids there and they could all be in different grades.
There are a lot of people that I interviewed that said I was the only kid in my class. And for the most part, the one-room schoolhouse memories are very nostalgic from the people that I interviewed. But every now and again, I come across a person who said, if you want a rosy story, I'm not the person you want to talk to. And so I say, well, what happened? What's your story? And one particular girl had said she went to a one-room schoolhouse in the 1980s, and she said she was the only girl in the school. And so it was very lonely for her. She begged and begged her parents to let her go to the Ubley schools because she craved that social interaction with other girls. And so different people had different experiences. There was another girl in that same school, an older sister. She was the only girl in her third grade class. And she wonders now whether her teacher really just didn't want to teach one student in that class because she had to go through the trouble of creating tests and homework for one class, for one pupil. She was a very good student, so the teacher told her, at the end of third grade, I want you to take the third grade exam, and I want you to skip fourth grade, and you'll go into fifth grade. That was a great idea, but no one told this poor girl that you learn multiplication tables in fourth grade.
Uh-oh.
So when she hit fifth grade, she told me she laid her head down on the desk and bawled because it was so overwhelming to think you skip a whole grade of learning.
It's not like you were exceeding standards and you got to skip the grade because you were in advanced class. As you say, it was just logistics, didn't want to have to teach a whole separate grade.
She wonders that, but she has to laugh, though, because she says it all turned out okay because I majored in math in college, so she must have gotten those multiplication tables down eventually. I did want to also mention that I have learned a lot in the process of researching. When I researched the histories of the schoolhouses that are in Volume 1, I did a lot of oral history, talked to as many people as I could, and it was over 150 people that contributed to each book, former students, school board members, and teachers. And during that process, I discovered that with that state collection of data, the State Archives in Lansing have all of these annual reports on microfilm from 1859 to 1933, and then in hard copy books from 1933 until 1953. I asked where the rest was, and they said eventually the State Board of Education would release more documentation to them, but that is what they had at this point. And so every year I go to the State Archives and I research, and I take my husband David with me, and in the fall I drive the tractor that tops the that runs the topper for the sugar beets, and then the spring I drive the tractor for the bean roller, and so we kind of do a swap. I'm not the most mechanical person around, and so we get in the archives and we have the bank of microfilm machines, and he knows which schools I'm after researching, and he lines all the machines up for me, and we play round robin, and I go from machine to machine with my research until our eyes bleed and we call it a day.
Wow. Was discipline different back then? I mean, you know, maybe that's why some like it and some didn't. Maybe, you know, some schools may have been a little tougher that way. I mean, I know today, when I went to school, I went to public school, and the people who went to parochial school told us how their discipline, it was totally different. I can imagine one-room schools were different yet.
I don't have any physical documentation at the state level about discipline.
These things weren't, you know, documented that much. You just got a note sent home.
But I certainly have heard a lot of firsthand stories, not all from happy students.
No.
And one student who, it was interesting to me that he learned something from this, and I almost was a little bit shocked by it, but he was not the best speller. And so if he studied, he would do okay. But if he didn't study, there were problems. And so he had a spelling test of 10 words, and for every word wrong, you held out your hand and the teacher whacked it with a ruler. And so he missed a number of words on it because he had ball to play the night before and more important things to do. And so after school that day, the teacher never called him, so he thought, I'm going to slide out of the schoolhouse before I get my knuckles whacked. So he went home feeling pretty good about himself, and the next day the teacher said, excuse me, but I need you to stay for a minute. And she says, you know, you had some punishment coming yesterday and you did not acknowledge it. You didn't come to me, and so today you get twice.
Oh my gosh.
And while I think that almost sounds horrific, he said that it was a lesson that stuck with him, and any time going forward that he didn't do something quite right, he immediately acknowledged it.
Well,
and another,
and they eventually nicknamed him Lefty.
There was another story, not quite so nostalgic, in a Paris Township school, where a young girl, their immigrant family came, and she had a terrible time pronouncing the number 7 and the number 8, or got those numbers mixed up, and so the teacher also took her in the coat room, and out came the ruler to her hand so hard that it broke a bone in her finger.
Oh my gosh.
And so this girl was terrified to go to school. She couldn't even understand all of the language that was going on.
Because she could have been raised in a house where they predominantly spoke Polish or German or another language, and she goes to school and has to speak English. And
a lot of the family spoke their native language in the home, so you've got Polish-speaking family members, parents and grandparents in the home, and these kids would get in trouble when they went to school because they couldn't speak English, and then they would go home and try to speak English, and they would get in trouble at home because they were not speaking Polish. So this girl with the broken finger now, who's terrified to go to school, there was a big culvert outside, and so every day from then on, she decided she was going to crawl in there and hide. Well, after the third day, her mother got word that her daughter wasn't in school, which was odd because she certainly left every day and came home every day at the right times. And so her mother, it took a couple of people to pull her out of this culvert, and her dad worked in the city in Detroit, came back on the weekends, and she told her dad what had happened. He moved the family out of the area because it was beyond the call of what was necessary. And so there are certainly some stories that have left their mark that aren't good, but overall, the majority of the people that I talk to value the education they got in the one-room schoolhouse and really still appreciate the teachers that guided them in doing so.
They might have told you different while they were going there. We human beings have a wonderful tendency to filter out the past, and you know, when my folks were around, they used to talk about the good old days and blah blah blah, and it's like, you remember, this is the Great Depression you're talking about. You know, but we were on a farm and we had food. But it's like, you know, this was still the Great Depression. You're calling the good old days. And so we do have this tendency to remember fondly of things and kind of filter out what wasn't so great.
And we do have a good tendency to do that. And while
that has to make it difficult for you, though, doesn't it? Because you're looking for, you know, to do a book, you want accuracy, and you know, you'd like to think that it was the good old days, but like you say, you found instances that there weren't. Does this kind of hurt you in trying to get a real true representation, rather, because you're using a lot of people's memories that may be sweetened over
well,
the years?
Well, in my introduction, I do make a note that people's memories are only as good as time allows, and people do remember things differently. But I value the oral histories that I collect from all of these people, mm-hmm. because the hard statistical data that I get from the state archives and even at the local level, sometimes I find old boxes that had school board minutes in dating back to 1864. Those oral memories help personalize that schoolhouse and they help soften it. Truly, one schoolhouse is the same as the next, is the same as the next. But the people who attended these schoolhouses don't think so. Their schoolhouse was special to them, and the things that happened in that schoolhouse are what make that schoolhouse worth researching.
Facts are facts. People bring it alive.
That's correct. And so, too, do the pictures that they're so willing to share. Over 150 contributors dug in their attics and in their basements for old pictures. One of the oldest pictures in Volume 2 is from Appen Schoolhouse, and it's dated 1897. And it has the teacher, Andrew Boomhauer, there with his top hat. And it must have been the end of the school year or a special picture day, because parents are also in the picture. All of the ladies are wearing hats and they're all in their best dressed finery. And so these pictures give us a look at what the clothing was like in the era. Some of these students didn't have shoes. They went to school year round without shoes, because back in the Depression, not everybody had shoes to go around. And some other good history that I found at the State Archives brought the 1871 and the 1881 fires alive that hit this region. In 1871, the report filed for Paris Township said, no data collected, all schoolhouses in Paris Township burned. And in Bingham Township in 1881, Bingham Township was hit especially hard. And some of these districts had built a schoolhouse 10 years prior. It burnt in the 1871 fire. They rebuilt. It burnt in the 1881 fire. There were school board minutes that I resurrected that had one line item, motion made to build a new school, and that was it. And another piece of documentation that I found when they're working to restore their schoolhouses, one Bingham Township school, the bell was the only thing that survived. And so as I look at...
It was probably well-tempered after the fire. Were the boards basically just the families around there? Did they just kind of get together and volunteer what they're going to do? Today we have elections.
And there were elections then too, but they were usually fathers in the district who had children going to school there, because they had a vested interest in the success of that school because they were sending their kids there. And so it's interesting that in the early days, it was a three-man school board. Rarely was there a woman on the school board unless the man passed away in office. Sometimes his wife assumed the position. But it wasn't until decades later when you start to see female names show up on the three-person school board.
Were most of the teachers male? Was that a male profession at the time, or 50-50?
It was a mixture. Interesting, though, with World War I coming on, there was a Mr. Boniface Pulaski who left to go to the war, and so he was replaced by another gentleman. 2 months later, that gentleman left to go to the war, and so the third teacher there for that schoolhouse was a woman. During World War II, especially, with the increased number of schools in that era, and the large number of male teachers who went off to war, though those positions opened up for women. Not all of those women were qualified. And it would document on the records that I looked at that said working now toward her certification, because she was the best they had at the time and she was going to show an effort to become the teacher they needed her to be. But there were hard times and they called for drastic measures.
Did the schools basically, kind of like a church, have to have a parish for the like they have for the preacher? Did they have to have a housing available for the teacher that came? you're coming into an area with a very limited amount of families, and I'm sure they just don't have empty houses sitting around, and you had to be within a distance where you could actually get there all the time. Was housing accommodation something they had to consider?
In the early days, most often the teacher boarded with the nearest family, and that family was compensated by the school board to house the teacher. For the most part, I would think that the kids would be mortified if their teacher was living with them. But it's not the reaction that I'm getting. The teacher baled hay when it was time to bale hay after school. The teacher went out and helped with chores if they had their lessons prepared for the next day. And so they brought that teacher into their home as part of the family.
They mostly, though, didn't come with a family.
They were single. They were single.
And today, teachers have families, and, you know, they come to a school district, and they either rent or buy a house, and sometimes establish this is our home and where we're going to stay. Where in those days, you know, if you didn't have a farm, you know, everybody needed the land.
And Michigan law stated that married women could not teach.
Oh boy, that would go over well today.
Only single women were allowed to teach, and once they got married, then they were no longer available, because a paying position like that with some esteem in the area needed to go to a man who was providing for his family. It was a different world then. We didn't have two-income families. So the single people occupied those positions. Now that law eventually got repealed, and more so, especially during the wartime, you have all kinds of females filling these positions because they are now available.
They're open, and they needed to go to a bigger pool, basically, because people were on the move. The men were gone, and the women were taking over more and more positions and everywhere.
And one of the teachers were burned in the fire. Some records survived. Interestingly enough, even though there was an 1871 fire and an 1881 fire, there was one school in particular in Bingham Township where the records survived all the way back to 1864. And I wondered how that could be. But there was a line item later that was written that the director's house was spared. And the director of the school board had those records in his house. So even though the school burnt, those records lived on. And the Michigan State Legislature, after the 1881 fire, appropriated $15,000 for construction of 46 schools in Tuscola County and Huron County. And if you do the math, that's $326 per school. That's a nice start, but in the records that I looked at, it took about $500 to $600 in order to equip the school with new desks and all the essentials that they needed to meet those state guidelines of having an American flag on the grounds, having a fence surrounding the schoolyard, having a library within the school. And so while the people from that area worked to resurrect their schoolhouse, because education was very important to them, and it really becomes evident when you look at these old records how important it was, because within months school was back in session.
Was it all work there? I mean, today in the younger grades especially, and even the older grades, you have phys ed. That was an essential part of, you know, burning off that energy that built up during the day, you know, so you could get back to study. Did they have breaks, or did they just do it at lunch? Or have you heard anything on that through your studies?
They had the school day usually ran from 9 until 4 or 9 until 3, depending on the time frame. In the early days, it was 9 until 4. And there was a morning recess and an afternoon recess, and there was a 1 hour long break during the noon hour for the children to eat their lunch. In the wintertime, they went to the next door neighbor farmer's pond that had flooded over in his field, and they ice skated, whether it was on the soles of their feet or the old clamp-on skates that they had. Soccer and always baseball was a good standby. Most kids in the one-room schoolhouse had a love for baseball, and so they're all Tiger fans now. But
all that Abner double day.
One girl from one of the Bingham Township schools, it's evident in the pictures, the boys had knee-high work boots that they wore. And one of the girls, in her memories of recollections, told me her leg still has the ding from one boy's work boot when they were playing soccer and he missed the ball.
Uh-oh, didn't miss her.
So they certainly had a lot of fun in their day, too. It wasn't all work, but...
Because that's essential. We've learned, you know, through studies now, that kids need this, and they just did it on instinct because they knew the kids needed to blow off a little energy, go back to school and do their their math. And
they also went to neighboring schools for ball games. The younger students were released at 2:30, and so the older students would hop on their bicycles or all pile in the teacher's car, whether it was standing on the running boards or in the trunk or as many as could get a ride. And they
you're only talking about, you know, a handful of kids at any school, and you're releasing kids. Did the parents come and get them, or did they just walk home 3 miles? Some of these kids are pretty young. We wouldn't consider that today. But back then, you know, I'm thinking back then, we still probably had wolves and coyotes and stuff.
For the most part, they made their trek on foot, both ways, no more than 3 miles, and they got pretty good at cutting through the fields.
People, it was both ways uphill, but that's a whole
and 14 miles during a snowstorm.
Well, because they kept going in circles, I guess.
But I do want to mention that the Volume 2 has an index in it, which is something I learned after the completion of Volume 1. A lot of genealogists look to my book to try to find relatives' names, and I realized that, and I realized how important an index was during research. And so there are over 2,500 entries in the index, and they're not all student names. They're teachers' names, they're school board members, they're old businesses that existed in that area, because the school board minutes said they went to the Rexall drugstore for writing tablets. And so it's a nice addition, I think, to my book. And within the next week or so, I will have a link on my website at steinexpressions.com. So if you want to see if one of your relatives are listed in the index, you can go to my website, steinexpressions.com, look for Schools of Yesteryear 2, and click on the link for the index to see all the names that are in there.
And that's for those three townships.
Yes, Bingham, Paris, and Sheridan Township.
And your future books, because you've got plenty of townships yet to go.
I am.
You'll have those links available as well for people who are searching Ancestry, because any help they get, they greatly appreciate.
Yes. I am currently researching schoolhouses for my next Volume 3 book, and those will be the 11 schoolhouses that stood in Bloomfield, Gore, and Rubicon Township in Huron County. And so if you attended one of those schools in Bloomfield, Gore, or Rubicon Township and want to give me a call at 989-864-5528 and share your memories or dig out your old photos, I would be happy to talk with you. And my schoolhouse columns continue in the Lakeshore Guardian. I have a monthly column in there called Schools of Yesteryear. Right now, the Gore Township School is being featured, and because of the location of Gore Township, there only was one school in that district.
Well, it's a small township to begin with, but it could be one of the early ones. It's along the shore, and where you had the availability of getting in before roads and everything else through the wooded interior were done.
And township records and state records reflect the origin of that school and how many schools were built over the course of its lifetime. And Julie Purdy of the Lakeshore Guardian, she's the publisher of the Lakeshore Guardian, designed all of my books, and she just did a phenomenal job designing Schools of Yesteryear too. I received a phone call just this week from a lady from Indiana complimenting the layout and the organization of the book. And so I owe a lot to Julie, and I thank her for her good work on this book. She was the one that encouraged me to back in 2008 to make a school book to start with, and I told her I was good with the newspaper, I'm happy with that, and she told me you need to move outside your comfort area to grow and learn. And so I thought about that, and I thought if I went geographically, maybe this would be a nice historical research tool. And so I contacted her and said, I think you're right, I'd like to make a book and I'd like you to design it. And what did she tell me? I don't know how to make a book. I just know how to design the newspaper. And so what did I tell her? You need to move outside of your comfort area to grow and learn. And so we put our heads together, and it's been a pleasure, and I'm glad she's been along for the journey.
And the books, do you find it's basically the local people basically buying it? I would imagine libraries want these things. They'd love to have the local history around. Do you find like the state library and stuff is looking to have copies of this so they're in their archives as well? Because all of this can get lost.
Certainly all of the major universities tend to purchase books like this from Ann Arbor to Michigan State to the state libraries. The Bentley Library in Ann Arbor purchased a book recently. And all of the local libraries throughout the state usually have a Michigan history section or a local author section. And so while I haven't populated all of those libraries yet, certainly that's on the list of things to do. And people can purchase them locally at Ace Hardware in Bad Axe and also Harbor Drug in Harbor Beach. The book is a hardcover. It has...
It's perfect for a coffee table.
It's a coffee table book. 320 pages and over 400 pictures. And it's also available online at www.steinexpressions.com.
That's to purchase, not the whole book. She's trying to do the author thing
there. Yes.
And, you know, she wants you to have the book. And there's something to the feel of a real book. I'm old school, okay, I know. I have a tablet, I have everything, but there's just something about the feel of a book.
I like a book in my hands. There's certainly a nod to the technology of the day, but a historical book like this feels nice in your hands. And also, if you'd like to order through the mail and send a check, cost for shipping is $5, so the check would be for $44 payable to Stein Expressions LLC. But you can call me at 989-864-5528, and I'll give you the mailing address for that. And if you're of the type of people like I am who I want Volume 2, I don't really know anybody in Volume 1, but I couldn't bear to have Volume 2 stand alone on the shelf without Volume 1. I am having a sale for half off on Volume 1, so if you're interested in owning both so Volume 2 doesn't look so lonely on the shelf, give me a call for that too. And I have a number of book signings coming up, so you can come and meet me in person. I'll be happy to put a personal inscription in your book and sign it. On Thursday, May 15th, I'll be at the Bad Axe District Library beginning at 6:30 p.m. I'll have a 45-minute slide presentation, and I'll be sharing some more information about the students and teachers in the one-room schools themselves, from the construction of the schools, log, frame, or brick. And eventually, when the students populated those schools, some schools in the area went to two-room schools to accommodate the influx of the baby boom. And then a few days later, on Saturday, May 17th, I'll be at the Pigeon District Library from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. They are having their Authors Day at the Pigeon Library. It's sponsored by HOG, which is the Huron Area Writers Group. They have a youth writing contest, and that day they'll be announcing the winners for that. They've asked me to be their guest speaker that day, and I'm very honored for that, and I will have books available for sale there from 11 until 2. On Wednesday, May 21st, at 1 p.m., I'll be visiting Parisville for the Huron County Catholic League of Women. I know there will be Mass first at the church, followed by a luncheon, and I will be the 1 p.m. speaker. On Thursday, May 22nd, I will be at the Sleeper Public Library in Ubley, beginning at 6:30 p.m. for a brief talk. And on Saturday, May 24th, I will be at the Port Austin Farmers Market from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m., and let's hope for sunshine and 70.
Any thoughts? Normally a book such as this today is created in a computer anyway. Any thoughts of an e-edition? I brought that up kind of because I do like the feel of a book. But any thoughts on that? You have people, you know, maybe from California, you know, that maybe would just like to have the book and not the shipping costs. I mean,
I haven't really investigated that process yet. I have asked a few questions, and from what I've heard, e-books produced locally by people who maybe they have them on Amazon or places like that where you can download an ebook, there are not a lot of sales to that. It's nice to be able to say your book is on Amazon, and it's nice to be able to say you have an ebook, but it all comes down to the bottom line and
the numbers,
and it comes back to it's a nice looking book, and I would like the hard copy myself, so that's what I'm sticking with.
Well, stick with what works. How long does it take you to do one of these books? I mean, you're working on your next one. Is this like a year-long project or more?
Well, if all I did was research one-room schoolhouses, the process would be a bit quicker.
Well, you got to eat and live and have a life, too. Beyond that, you know, there is obsession, and you don't want to go that route.
My Lakeshore Guardian monthly deadlines keep me focused, so I will continue to research well beyond the next few years, that's for sure. It took 6 years to produce the first book, township by township, school by school, and I had other writing commitments and deadlines as well, and it took another 6 years to get the second one done. So I know people are waiting, and I thank them for their patience. I had a lot of people waiting for this book, and so dig in your attics for me and give me a call at 989-864-5528 and tell me about your schoolhouse experiences in Huron County.
Now, when you started this, you know, through articles in the Lake Guardian, Did you just find that, gee, there was a whole lot more I wish I could have put in there? That, you know, you have space limitations, and we have it on the air with how much time you have, it with how much column space. You just found so much more that, you know, it almost seemed kind of like a waste not to get that out there.
Well, the Lakeshore Guardian is very generous with their space in that they will continue the column from month to month. Mm-hmm. So it's not unusual for a schoolhouse history to run 4 months. And what's a blessing is my article first appears in the Lakeshore Guardian, and the Lakeshore Guardian puts out up to 10,000 copies monthly. So people get this newspaper, they see, right now they see Gore School. I've already had two people contact me who attended Gore School that I didn't know they went there. One woman was from the other side of the state. She lived across from the school just prior to the Depression, and she contacted me with her memories. And
she didn't have the teacher living with him, did she?
She didn't have the teacher living with him, but she told me a great story that we put in this issue's Reader's Right in the Lakeshore Guardian. She said there were two boys, and they didn't necessarily care for the maintenance man, and so they went to the next door neighbor farmer's field, rounded the bull up and herded him into the entrance, tied his tail to the bell rope, and left the building. So it took a little bit of time. Every time the bull moved, the bell went. Every time the bell went, the bull went berserk. And so the maintenance man had a bit of fixing to do come Monday morning. So it's stories like that that soften up the statistical data that I collect.
Now, you're sure this wasn't just pure bull?
Not according to her.
Not according to her.
And I had another gentleman yesterday that told me that his sister was on the front page who attended Gore School, and he had a picture from the 1950s that I didn't even know existed, and so he's going to be bringing that to me this week. So with running the articles in the Lakeshore Guardian first, it builds awareness not only about how much importance the Lakeshore Guardian puts on history and preserving it, but also building awareness that I'm working on this project, and if you've got something to contribute, it's not too late to call me.
Do you find that, you know, the things that are preserved for you sometimes need a whole lot of work? I mean, the pictures, you know, you go back just to the 50s and they're all faded. I mean, they're a little better in the past because they were a little more toxic. But, you know what I mean? But the things fade and they're not as sharp as we're kind of used to. Do you find that you need to do a lot of work sometimes in these pictures to make them quality enough for your book?
Well, and that's really all Julie Purdy. I will receive the photos. I scan them in as is. And if they need to be prettied up, she takes care of all of that for me. I don't have the intelligence or the patience to make things a little better in that department, but I have had people who have contacted me that had an old record book, and I'll say, oh, I want to see it. Can we connect so that I can look at it? Can I borrow it for a week? And I'm like, well, there's raccoon bites out of the end of it, and you really don't want to see it. So, but I do. I can wear gloves.
But you told me about it.
I know, so I have to check it out. So not every piece of memorabilia is in A1 condition, but for me, they're all worth looking at, and then we'll make that decision as we go, whether it's reproducible or not.
Well, I could keep talking forever. We're getting out of time here. Again, tell people how they can get a hold of you, what the website is if they want to order a book, and they're going to be available. They're available now at Ace Hardware and Harbor Drugs in Harbor Beach if people want to kind of peruse it a little bit before they buy.
Absolutely. You can give me a call at 989-864-5528. I'll give you some shipping information. And you can also order it online at www.steinexpressions.com. You can also access the index on my website at steinexpressions.com. That should be available within a week or two. So if you want to peruse the index before you purchase, feel free to check it out. And put some dates on the calendar and come and see me in person at the local libraries that are kind enough to host me.
I thank you for coming in today, and good luck on your next project. Hopefully not quite 6 years, but the books are beautiful, and there's lots of images in there and lots of things to peruse as far as history, local history. History from right here. It's not a book about Arizona or Colorado or wherever. Right here, close to home.
And
thanks.
Grandma's picture might even be in it. Thanks for having me on the air today, Craig.
Thank you for coming out. Our guest today on the program has been Jenna Stein, and the books are called Schools of Yesteryear. She's got volume 1 she put out years ago, and now she's got volume 2, and 2 has the index. It'll be online pretty soon, so check it out. You can go to Ace Hardware, you can go to Harbor Drugs and see it for yourself firsthand. Coming up at the top of the hour, of course, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news. Keep it right here at WLEW.